You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on October the 2nd, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Markus Hippi, and Victoria Graham.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be in Italy, where Prime Minister Enrico Letta faces great uncertainty ahead of today's confidence vote.
And Brazilian journalist Bruno Garces will join us to set the day's agenda. What do you have for us today, Bruno?
Well, the Rio police has indicted 10 police officers on the disappearance and killing of a man in a local shanty town in last July.
We'll hear more about this later.
We'll travel deep behind the great red walls of the Kremlin to uncover some of Russia's most startling historic events with author Catherine Merridale.
And we'll meet the Lebanese entrepreneur behind the smartphone application that will allow people to pinpoint and avoid street clashes and gunfire.
You hear a gunshot? Ideally, in 30 seconds, you should get a notification, the source location of the gunshot. Yani, you should know exactly where the person is located on a map, and it will show on your mobile phone.
All that, plus we'll get the latest news from Seoul, review the US newspapers, and we'll play some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
Before all that, let's catch up on the headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. President Obama is insisting he won't allow Republicans in Congress to hold the US to ransom as the government shutdown continues. More than 700,000 federal employees have been forced into unpaid leave. Republicans in the House of Representatives say they'll only agree a new budget if Mr. Obama agrees to suspend his health care reforms. He has urged them to think again.
This is only going to happen when Republicans realize they don't get to hold the entire economy hostage over ideological demands. No, this shutdown is not about deficits. It's not about budgets. This shutdown is about rolling back our efforts to provide health insurance to folks who don't have it. This, more than anything else, seems to be what the Republican Party stands for these days.
Italy's Prime Minister today faces a vote which could see the collapse of the country's coalition government. Silvio Berlusconi ordered his ministers to resign at the weekend, carrying out his threat to bring down the government over his conviction for fraud. But his deputy has said MPs should back Enrico Letta in today's vote, and there are signs that he will survive. But Leonardo Molino, who's a professor of political science at Lewis University in Rome, thinks Mr. Letta's government has no long-term future.
I expect a no-confidence vote for Letta. That would be the crisis. If Letta is able to make a short-term agreement, if able to postpone for a few months the elections, then this is a positive result for him, and there will be a positive reaction by the markets.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has told the UN General Assembly that a charm offensive by Iran's new president is a ruse, and he's declared that Israel's ready to stand alone to deny Tehran an atomic weapon. He questioned the trustworthiness of Hassan Rouhani, who last week acknowledged and condemned the Holocaust, made diplomatic overtures to the United States, and spoke by telephone with President Obama. Comparing him to his hardline anti-Israel predecessor, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Netanyahu said that while Ahmadinejad was a wolf in wolf's clothing, Rouhani is a wolf in sheep's clothing, who thinks he can pull the wool over the eyes of the international community. The United States and South Korea have signed a new strategy to deter North Korea's possible use of nuclear arms and other weapons of mass destruction. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel and his South Korean counterpart Kim Kwang-jin also agreed to review the timing of the transfer of wartime command control of their combined forces on the Korean Peninsula from the US military to South Korea. Mr. Hagel said the deal agreed on what was described as tailored deterrence against the threat from the North.
Of particular concern are North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile programs, its proliferation activities, and its chemical weapons. There should be no doubt that any North Korean use of chemical weapons would be completely unacceptable.
The U.S. mission in Venezuela has defended three diplomats expelled by President Nicolas Maduro, rejecting charges they're involved in espionage and that Washington is trying to destabilize the country. Maduro claimed the three had met right-wing opposition leaders and encouraged acts of sabotage against his country's electricity grid and economy. One of the three, Kelly Keidling, who's temporarily in charge of the mission, said the accusations had no basis whatsoever. She insisted that it's part of the job of US diplomats in Venezuela to meet different sectors of civil society in the country. Poland's Treasury Minister says he's determined to get compensation for a series of problems on Boeing Dreamliners used by the state-operated carrier LOT. Wladimir Karpinski told Polish radio he's very angry about the problems and he'll be seeking compensation from Boeing with full determination. LOT has already said it's demanding compensation for lost revenue linked to a number of Dreamliner problems. It's given Boeing until the end of the year to settle over faults or face court action. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you to Barney Burnham. It's 16:06 in Tokyo, 11:06 in Moscow, and 8:06 in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. Time now to set the day's agenda. And joining us now in the studio is Brazilian journalist and Monocle regular Bruno Garces. Welcome to the show, Bruno, and good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Your first story is actually getting already a lot of headlines in Brazil. It's about a man called Amarildo de Souza, who's actually been missing for a while. And now there are reports that Rio's civil police has indicted 10 policemen for the disappearance of him.
Yes, well, Amarildo de Souza, he was a resident of the Rocinha favela. This is Rio's biggest favela. And this group of police officers are accused of kidnapping him, followed by his death and the concealment of his body. And the civil police has also called for the arrest of the PM, of the military police. He had been last seen when he was stopped during a police operation in last July. Witnesses claim that he was entering a police car on that day. And since then, it has become the buzzword of social network sites. The sentence, "Where is Amarildo?" that has been repeated, shouted out as a slogan. During the several street protests that we saw throughout Brazil, it became a banner. So this is actually a story that is not likely to go away so soon, I would say, even for perhaps months.
But why? Why this particular case? Because this happens a lot, doesn't it?
Exactly. That's the point. I think it has a lot to do with this political emerging that we saw, this political awareness that we saw, and at a moment in which Brazilians have said enough, we're not going to take any more that police officers are able to commit a crime and get away with it. And I think this is pretty much what it represents. I think it's a statement more than anything else, at a moment in which Rio was just selling the occupation of its favelas by police officers, the so-called UPPs, the Unities of Pacification, as being a success operation. And this offers an alternative view that things are not that simple, that there are still ingrained practices of the past that are being carried on.
Investigation obviously takes place now, and whatever the results are, do you think the big public is going to believe the results?
Well, I think so. I think, and maybe even out of instinct of survival, the police opted for a expressive reaction to that. It wasn't just to brush it under the carpet. It was to show that it means business, I think.
And you talk about these police pacification units. It's supposed to be promoting an honest police force. Is this a bit of a concern in the run-up to the 2014 World Cup and, of course, the Olympic Games in 2016?
Most definitely. I think there is that concern. I think that that the police authorities can be held to account, can be trustworthy, can be seen as being on the side of the people and not being just a force that compiles many irregular activities on a daily basis.
Bruno, shall we go to your story number two now? It's about the diplomatic void between the United States and Venezuela that seems to go on and on.
Exactly. Now, in a new development, the U.S. has expelled three Venezuelan diplomats from the country. This is the business representatives of Venezuela in the U.S., Calixto Ortega, the second secretary, and the Houston Council. And the move is a retaliation against similar actions taken by Venezuela. On Tuesday, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro had accused three U.S. diplomats of plotting to sabotage his country's economy and gave them exactly 48 hours to leave Venezuela. So the U.S. took a very similar, identical stance.
Maduro has a little bit of a reputation in this, though, doesn't he, of making allegations against the U.S. And he also is almost paranoid. He thinks he's had five assassination attempts against him as well. So how much of this can we take as read?
It's one of the attempts apparently happened last week. That's why he didn't go to the UN. Mm. So that's at least his claim. Well, it seems to be a tactic that was successfully, to a certain extent, used by his predecessor, President Hugo Chavez. But I don't know if Maduro is opting for the most productive path, given that he's not as charismatic. He didn't win his election by a landslide. It was a narrow victory. The opposition forces have become bolder and stronger. So it might be a bit of a false step there. We'll see how it goes.
Talking about President Maduro, on Tuesday, indeed accused three U.S. diplomats of plotting to sabotage Venezuela's economy, and also supposedly these same individuals have been taking part in a power grid sabotage. Does anyone actually believe these accusations?
That's the point. I think at this time it doesn't strike as strong as it did during the more colorful days and more colorful personality of Hugo Chavez. I don't think it's a stunt Nicolas Maduro can do as well. Chavez was more of a talent for that. Maduro, as I said, has less charisma, and therefore I don't know if this is the most fruitful road to be taken, but we'll see how it goes for him.
Let's go to your third story now, and Mexico's El Universal reports how the government's plans to end state-owned oil company is being exploited politically, and it's starting to have wider implications as well.
Yes, well the opposition representative, Cuauhtémoc Cardenas, from the opposition PRD party, he's holding meetings with businessmen from various companies in the country who actually oppose the measure. Well, this is somewhat expected, given that President Enrique Peña Nieto has very ambitious plans to break the 75-year-old monopoly of the state-owned oil company Pemex, and he announced them last month. So this is a national issue that has a very strong symbolic importance, significance for Mexicans. This is one of the most powerful companies in the country, if not the most powerful.
That's actually something we talked about on Monocle 24 already a bit earlier. But what are the latest developments? How is this project being exploited politically, for example?
Well, this team-up of forces that oppose this measure could hamper some of his plans. I think Peña Nieto will be forced at least to make concessions, which he is already doing. There'll be tax exemptions offered to Pemex. That's one of them, and those tax exemptions will be higher than those offered to other state-owned oil companies. But the fact of the matter is, he's trying to attract foreign investment from companies like ExxonMobil, Chevron, and by giving them the chance to pump crude oil in Mexico for the very first time since 1938. But that implies in changes to the constitution. I think these opposition forces can make life a bit more difficult for him in implementing these necessary changes to get these reforms.
Bruno, appreciate you coming in. Thank you very much indeed. Brazilian journalist Bruno Garces.
Coming up, we are in Italy as the country's parliament prepares to hold a vote of confidence.
This week, Monocle 24 unpacks the world's most important and least understood industry, international shipping. It provides your shoes and phones, sunglasses and cars. But what happens between the factory floor and your front door? Tune in for gun-toting pirates and widening canals, modern clippers and eco-friendly designs. We'll also tour the biggest ship ever built. That's all this week on The Globalist at 6 a.m. London time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The Italian political crisis rumbles on. Today's Italy's parliament is due to hold a vote of confidence in the governing coalition. Prime Minister Enrico Letta is desperately trying to save his government after five ministers belonging to Silvio Berlusconi's People of Freedom Party resigned, causing divisions in the coalition to widen sharply only 5 months after it was formed.
But attempts to topple Letta appear to be faltering as senior party figures in Silvio Berlusconi's fractious PDL party urged Italian lawmakers to defy Berlusconi and back the Prime Minister. So, what can we expect to happen today? Can Letta maintain his grip at the top? And what does this mean for Italy's struggling economy? Well, to explore this further, we're joined on the line by John Foote, Professor of Italian Studies at Bristol University, and Giuseppe Ragusa, a Professor of Economics at Rome's Luis Guido Carli University. You're both very welcome on the show. Thank you for joining us. John Foote, first of all, I'll start with you. Reading social media overnight and this morning, many people are saying, how is it possible that one self-obsessed old man, as some people put it, can hold the government and economy of a large, wealthy Western democracy hostage? Is this the beginning of the end for Silvio Berlusconi?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and you'd have to go back. Berlusconi, it's almost 20 years now since Berlusconi first entered politics, and ever since then, there's been a very, very strong conflict of interest between his personal business and legal issues and the issues of Italy as a whole. So that's one issue that has been ongoing for ages. And it's all come to a head, I think, with the definitive conviction for tax fraud, which Berlusconi suffered very recently. And this has led to the government really being on the edge of falling. I think what's interesting at the moment, and with the confidence vote imminent, is that there seem to be cracks in his own very, very loyal, really, coalition. And that would be fascinating if an alternative to Berlusconi could emerge, possibly, on the right of Italian politics.
John, you mentioned the cracks there, and indeed quite a few politicians from Berlusconi's People of Freedom Party have said that they are actually going to back Prime Minister Enrico Letta. How alone is Berlusconi in this now?
Well, I think actually the majority of his coalition, and it's not surprising because it's kind of constructed in his own interests, will back him. But a significant minority are saying they won't. And I think that is very serious because he's always built a party which is very much in his own image, where he's a complete control, where people owe their careers to him. And I think that there's a kind of the choice between really bringing down the government for one person's personal interest, although ostensibly this is about tax, but of course everybody knows it isn't, and keeping the government going, although not that the government has done very much since it came to power 5 months ago. That alternative is quite stark, I think, and that those people in his coalition are faced with it. We'll see, because I would make no predictions at all before the vote, because Berlusconi has pulled these things out of the fire many times.
Giuseppe Ragusa, can I just bring you in now? Let's talk a little bit about the economic impact of this confidence vote today. One thing that markets generally hate is uncertainty, but there is an element of certainty here because the president of the European Central Bank has said that he's promising to do all it takes to keep Italy on track. Can you talk a little bit more about what's happening there?
Well, you can see actually the Mario Draghi, the president of the BCE, has been very important in the last few days. I think many people predicted on Friday night, Saturday and Sunday, that Monday would have been a terrible day for the markets. Instead, the markets reacted in some way in a negative fashion, but in a very moderate way. I think the main reason is because although there is a lot of instability in Italy now, we have a backstop. The BCE is acting as a strong backstop, and so you don't see the big fluctuation in yield, in spread, and you don't see the market tumbling. But I think the right question is, what's the importance of this confidence vote for the future of Italy from an economic standpoint? I think it's kind of crucial. I think the prediction that everybody's making is Letta is going to survive. A sizable minority of Berlusconi party is going to vote for Letta. And I think this is going to have two effects. The first one, I think, is going to put a hand to Berlusconi political life as we know it. And the second one is going to be the Letta that was politically dead on Friday is going to become one of the most powerful politicians in Italy. He's the one who won a very big battle and is going to be probably able to keep going as a prime minister until the natural end of the legislature, which is in 2015. Now, this for the first time probably we're going to, this is going to happen for the first time, we may have a prime minister and a government who have a majority and is going to be able to implement some of the reforms that everybody in Italy is talking about, but nobody's ever able to put them in practice and become them a reality. So, but at the same time, we don't know whether this sizable minority is going to vote for Letta. Is going to be able to support the government. So remember, this is a natural government. Even with this minority, this is a left party with joining a center-right party, and is also letting out many new forces that have been born in the last few years in Italy.
Giuseppe, in the case the governing coalition doesn't survive today's vote, what are the economic consequences?
I think in that case, the BCE is going to have serious difficulty to try to avoid big turmoil in the market. I think the markets are already discounting the Letta is going to get the confidence vote. If it's not going to get the confidence vote, the only solution, I think, is very difficult to find another solution. We are going to vote in the very near future. In this case, we are going to stay another 4 or 5 months without our government, without a political and economic agenda. So it's going to be problematic. That's why I think this is not going to happen. I think this afternoon, Letta is going to get the confidence vote.
Well, the world will watch with interest on today's confidence vote. I wish we had time for more, but John Foote, Professor of Italian Studies at Bristol University, and Giuseppe Ragusa, Professor of Economics at Rome's Luis Guido Carli University, thank you very much indeed.
Up next, we are in Seoul. This is Midori House on Monocle 24.
Shops. Who needs them? Well, we all do if you want a vibrant neighbourhood, a sense of community, healthy food, and outlets for small producers. In the October issue of Monocle, we check out the future of retail around the world and meet the people who believe in bricks and mortar shops. It's an inspiring round of global window shopping.
We're going electronic in the D section. First, we go to Zurich to meet the people who are helping jumpstart the image of electric bikes with the aid of improved design. And we'll also be deconstructing the look of BMW's first foray into e-cars. And then we'll turn off the switches altogether and go eco in Maui, paying a visit to a beautifully natural home built atop a cliff overlooking the Pacific.
In the edit section, we drive through the Tuscan Hills until we reach the Antinori Winery and take a private tour with a family that's been running the label since the 4th century. We also interview singer Alison Goldfrapp over a fish and chips meal in London. And if you're still hungry for more, check out our recipe for the perfect lobster roll, all the way from Maine, America's seafood capital.
And there's a lot more to ponder, digest, and enjoy too. The October issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to sign up now.
It is 8:24 in London and 16:24 in Seoul, where we head now to get the latest news from the region. And joining us on the line now is Monocle's Jason Strother. Welcome to the programme, Jason. First of all, yesterday in South Korea, there were quite massive Armed Forces Day ceremonies taking place, and there was also a new missile that was unveiled at the same time.
That's right, Marcus. If you thought North Korea could put on a military show, Seoul tried to counter that. What was unveiled yesterday is called the Hyunmoo-3. It's a cruise missile with a range of about 1,000 kilometers, and as South Korea's Ministry of Defense says, it can strike any target in North Korea. Even President Park Geun-hye spoke at this Armed Forces Day celebration. She said some pretty harsh words to the North, including calling its nuclear weapons program useless. Not going to go over well with Pyongyang.
This is a real warning shot, though, isn't it, from South Korea? It's usually North Korea that's doing this, isn't it?
Right, it is kind of a reversal here. I think, you know, when Park Geun-hye came into office earlier this year, I think there were a lot of concerns about how tough she would be to the North. Her predecessor, Lee Myung-bak, took some criticism after North Korea bombed a South Korean island in 2010. Many said that he didn't respond quick enough or with enough force. So I think she's felt that she has to live up to her father's reputation as being a strong-willed leader and really make it clear to the North that the South won't tolerate any sort of incursions again.
Jason, what can you tell about these new missiles that were indeed unveiled yesterday and got a lot of attention?
Well, like I said, it has a range of 1,000 kilometers. That's longer than any other cruise missile that South Korea has domestically produced. Another handful of missiles with a 500-kilometer range were also unveiled. It was a huge ceremony. 11,000 South Korean soldiers were mobilized. Close to 200 pieces of artillery, other mechanized vehicles were out for this show. It was quite a grand-scale parade that the South put on.
Can we go to our next story there? U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has been in South Korea for talks. Now, this is an interesting one because Seoul was due to resume control in 2015, but we believe there's going to be an extension as Washington has reaffirmed its commitment to South Korea.
Yeah, that's right, Victoria. Maybe South Korea might have the only military in the world that if war were to erupt, a foreign power would assume control. That's the way it's been since the Korean War, when South Korea handed over control of its military to the United States. Now, Washington gave back almost 20 years ago peacetime control to the South Korean Defense Ministry. But right, still, if Pyongyang were to launch an attack, the U.S. would assume operational control over the South Armed Forces. It was originally supposed to be handed over back over to South Korea last year, but Seoul keeps pushing the date back. It's scheduled right now, as it stands, the U.S. is supposed to hand over wartime operational control to the South at the end of 2015. But Seoul says because of recent threats by the North, its nuclear weapons development, its long-range rocket program, that it wants to push the date back even further.
Jason, let's move to your next story so we don't run out of time. The largest airport in South Korea is getting a new terminal.
Right, Incheon International Airport, already one of the most talked about airports in the world, a winner of many awards for the past 7 or so years. Ground broke recently on Terminal 2. It's not going to be finished until 2018, just ahead of the Winter Games here in South Korea. What the airport says is that they're quickly reaching capacity and that they need this new wing in order to accommodate all the many tourists that are coming, more and more tourists that come to Korea each year.
And Jason, just because we're running out of time, I do want to get onto your fourth story about schools possibly revising their policies towards students who date each other and indeed get pregnant at school.
Right. Some schools in South Korea have pretty strict policies. Students are not allowed to date. One school earlier this year was making couples do community service because they were found to be dating. And some schools have even expelled girls who are pregnant. And that's a big shame in South Korea. But now the Ministry of Education here is bringing these schools into line, saying that it can't abuse the rights of these students, these couples, as well as young women who are pregnant. Of course, this is probably going to meet with some negative reaction from the South Korean public, who, you know, having a teenage pregnant daughter is a source of shame for the entire family.
Jason Strother in Seoul, thank you very much for joining us on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
In the next half an hour of the programme, we'll uncover some of Russia's most startling historic events with author Catherine Merridale, and we'll meet the Lebanese entrepreneur behind the smartphone application that will allow people to pinpoint and avoid street clashes and gunfire.
You hear a gunshot? Ideally, in 30 seconds, you should get a notification, the source location of the gunshot. Yani, you should know exactly where the person is located on a map, and it will show on your mobile phone.
But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Victoria. President Obama insists he won't allow Republicans in Congress to hold the US to ransom as the government shutdown enters a second day. Republicans in the House of Representatives say they'll only agree a new budget if the president agrees to suspend his health care reforms. Italy's Prime Minister Enrico Letta faces a vote today which could see the collapse of the country's coalition government. Silvio Berlusconi ordered his ministers to resign at the weekend, but his deputy has said that MPs should back Mr. Letta. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has told the UN General Assembly that a charm offensive by Iran's new president Hassan Rouhani is a ruse, and he's declared that Israel is ready to stand alone to deny Tehran an atomic weapon. The US and South Korea have signed a new strategy to deter North Korea's possible use of nuclear arms and other weapons of mass destruction. They've also agreed to review the timing of the transfer of wartime command control of their combined forces in the region from the US military to South Korea. The US mission in Venezuela has defended three diplomats expelled by President Nicolas Maduro. They reject charges that they were involved in espionage and that Washington is trying to destabilize the country. Poland's Treasury Minister says he's determined to get compensation for a series of problems on Boeing Dreamliners used by the state-operated carrier LOT. LOT has already said it's demanding compensation for lost revenue, and it's given Boeing until the end of the year to settle over faults or face court action. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Barney Burnham. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Victoria Graham, and Marcus Hippie. Now for a preview of our weekly business show, The Entrepreneurs, we're heading to the Middle East. As war rages in Syria, that conflict is increasingly creeping across the border to Lebanon. One Lebanese entrepreneur, though, is developing an app to keep citizens safe from rising sectarian strife in his country.
Firas Bosna is developing Ways to Safety, a smartphone application that would allow people to pinpoint and avoid street clashes and gunfire. Monocle's Rebecca Collard finds out more in Beirut.
Clashes like these are now almost daily in the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli. This video shows armed men standing behind a building in an urban area of the city. A man fires a machine gun down the street. Someone fires back, and the men take turns firing on their opponents. Eventually, one fighter loads an RPG and fires down the street. For more than a year now, residents of this Jabal Mohsen neighborhood have suffered frequent clashes between local militias that support Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and those that support opposition Syrian rebel groups. Most here in Lebanon expect the security situation to get worse and that these sort of clashes will encroach on the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and other urban centers. One Lebanese entrepreneur has found a way he can help. Firas Wazain is developing a smartphone app that will allow users to locate and avoid clashes and flashpoints.
I was sitting in the salon and suddenly I heard a burst of gunshots. Lasted for about an hour. Then after an hour there was a bulletin on the TV that there was gunshots. The place was totally near my house. So I was surprised that no one knew about it for that long and the security forces were too late to come in. then the idea came to me that because I'm a telecommunication engineer and I directly went online, researched what about the idea, and found a company in the USA that does the same thing, but they're costly. Their application, they need to install hardware and pay for maintenance of this hardware and connect them to the internet on rooftop of buildings.
Just last month, not far from where Firas and I are standing, Bayan Bibi was hit with a stray bullet. I had to meet Bayan in her home a few blocks away.
Hi, Bayan Bibi.
It was a normal Saturday afternoon when Bayan's friend Rania called suggesting they take an afternoon stroll. The pair could hear the faint echo of gunfire, but it seemed far away as they walked down the central street of the popular Hamra district of Beirut. Then Bayan felt something pierce her back. She fell to the ground.
In this moment, the bullet entered my back. And after that, in this moment, I felt really, really I can't breathe. And I just called her name, Rania. Like all the street in Hamra heard me. And people came and what's wrong? I said, like a rock, a big rock, just hit me.
But it wasn't a rock that hit Bayan. It was a stray bullet, shot in the air by men celebrating the speech of a Lebanese politician blocks away. In Lebanon, when Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah and other key political figures make televised speeches, the sound of gunfire rings through neighborhoods across the city.
You know, lots of people are dying from this, but no one knowing about them.
Back on the street, Firas explains to me how his app will help people like Bayan stay safe. He says the goal is to protect innocent bystanders, who all too often become victims of clashes and gunfire. So let's say right now we were walking on this main street here in Hamra, and we heard gunfire. How could we react with the app?
You hear a gunshot. Ideally, in 30 seconds, you should get a notification, the source location of the gunshot. Yani you should know exactly where the person is located on a map, and it will show on your mobile phone. We're hoping on an accuracy about 25 meters, yani maybe a building.
And how would that work from our end? If we saw something happening, would we then register it? Is it like a...
We're crowdsourcing the audio signal without using user feedback. It's not subjective, it's objective.
Firas is a telecommunications engineer, and he says with a triangulation method, using the sound that would be automatically collected by the built-in microphone on a smartphone, he can almost instantly pinpoint the source of the gunshots.
Yani, for example, if we have like three users who have the app installed, that's the minimum. We need at least three in a 1 mile radius. Each of the three hears the gunshot at a different time. By using a triangulation method, you can locate the source location of the gunshot. Yani, if I hear it at a time, you hear it at a time, and the other person at another time, we will find the source location.
While Firas is developing this app in his native Lebanon, he says that he plans to market it abroad. Actually, he points out, gun deaths are much more common in the US and other countries than they are in Lebanon. And he expects most of his sales to come from these foreign markets.
I think the best place to implement this application is in the United States, then Brazil. Total, the number of gunshots of dead people resulting from direct gunshots per year is 100,000. 10,000 from the US and 30,000 from Brazil.
Firas's business model would have regular citizen users get the app for free, and big security and media organizations pay for the data. And how much do you think that you'll charge for the app?
Because our app is user-dependent. The more users we have, the more accurate. My vision is that we'll give it for the people who hear the gunshot for free, but media agencies and security agencies who want to cover a broader surface, they will pay for it as a subscription. Yani it will be a surface-based subscription. Yani.
It will cost around $100,000 to have Ways to Safety up and running. And Firas is now looking for investors who want to fund the development. For Monocle, in Beirut, I'm Rebecca Collard.
And you can hear more on brand new startups and innovative companies around the globe on this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs, premiering tonight at 1900 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be exploring the Kremlin with author Catherine Meridell next.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe, The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
When is a shop more than just a shop? Monocle visits three bricks and mortar businesses offering unique products and impeccable service in Toronto, Paris, and in Madrid.
The fascinating thing about spices is spices actually are a bit of the history of the opening up of the world, because different spices will tell you a little bit about where people went and what they brought back, and it's fascinating when you actually follow any spice.
Trader's secrets revealed in our Monocle briefing film, Spotlighting Retail, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 15:41 in Shanghai and 8:41 here in London. But now we travel to a world-famous landmark which survived earthquakes, devastating fires and at least three revolutions. Part citadel and part holy shrine, the Kremlin is one of the most significant buildings in Russian history.
Drawing on unseen archives and rare collections, historian Catherine Meridell traces the history of the fortified complex from where generations of leaders have ruled. Well, joining us now in studio to discuss this further is the author of The Red Fortress, The Secret Heart of Russia's History, Catherine Meridell herself. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
So as a symbol of power and history, the Kremlin is quite unique. What do you remember of your first visit there?
Well, my first visit was when I was a student a very long time ago. And the thing that struck me was how unexpected it was. In the centre of Moscow, which even in the 1980s, when I was a student, was a very modern looking city, here was this primeval building with peculiar towers and terrifying walls. And then right in the middle of it, so unlike Moscow, these gilded domes, which in the Soviet era just seemed out of place.
It's one thing to go and visit as a visitor. I haven't ever been before, and reading just part of this book, I would very much like to go. But you also gained a little bit more access, didn't you, to unseen archives. How did you manage that?
It was difficult. It required a lot of work by a lot of people to get permission to work in the Kremlin. And I was very fortunate and so grateful to the Kremlin research staff who helped me, because not many people get to do this, and it is a lot of work for them because they work in such a tiny space. The Kremlin's very large, but where the research staff work is up a tiny winding stone staircase at the top of a bell tower, and they have a really small library, which is in an old chapel, and then a reading room for their visitors, which they also share. And so they were making space for me in their space.
Why so small?
Well, I think the government requires a lot of the Kremlin. Mr. Putin occupies quite a lot of the Kremlin. And research into its history and culture really isn't the top priority.
As we mentioned already, you had an access to pretty much unseen archives and rare collections. In your own opinion, what were the most interesting things you learned there?
I think the texture of Russian history comes across, and also the personalities, not necessarily of the most important people, because we know a lot about most of the rulers, but the people who worked there, the builders and the architects and the cleaners and the person who mends the bells, These people came alive through the archives in a way that, perhaps in a rather impersonal way, the state control of archives doesn't let you see.
It's fascinating reading just part of this. And the Chapter 7, Firebird, you describe it, and something that I would never have thought about the Kremlin. You say for all its brand new mansions with their colonnades, the place continued to strike visitors as medieval after a century of legislation calling for stone and brick. Three quarters of its buildings were still built of wood, and it's something you just wouldn't imagine.
That's Moscow, of course, not the Kremlin itself.
Ah, right.
That's the city of Moscow. The Kremlin was already stone and brick by the 18th century. It had been wood before. But what was very striking about the Kremlin right up until the 19th century was how much of it was little rubble yards or piles of, you know, just dirt. And there were horses, there was horse manure everywhere, there was mud, people complained about it. And they also complained about how noisy it was, with cannon going off for rehearsals outside the bedroom windows of the elite when they were staying there, that sort of thing.
And that's what you do, you go into the history of Russia, really, not just of the Kremlin, describing in such great depth all its surroundings.
I started off to study the Kremlin and then discovered that you can't think about it without going into the whole history of the country. It's all swept up into those stones and bricks and all that gold, of course, too.
When you look at Russia, say, from the Western point of view, it's always looking slightly difficult to understand, problematic, and it's also seen that it seems that the West is often waiting for Russia to kind of sort itself. Did you learn something new about the Russian mentality yourself when you were working on this book?
I've spent so long working on the oral history of Russia. I've written two books already interviewing ordinary Russians about their lives. So I think the mentality of Russians comes across very clearly from doing that. What I learned from this book was something slightly different, which is that the state presents one face to the world and in reality is very different. And a lot of what we fear or what we imagine in this sort of blank face of the Russian state is actually for show. And behind it, they're like the swan swimming on the lake, you know, paddling like crazy to keep up this impression of eternity and calm and strength. Whereas if you look underneath, there's a great deal of improvisation going on.
So, Catherine, what's one of your favourite stories, more unexpected stories that you can tell us about today?
Oh, goodness.
There must be so many.
I feared you were going to ask that. I'd have to think about that one. I think the stories in Firebird are interesting. The architects trying to rebuild the Kremlin and trying to make it look more old than it really was by making it more and more Gothic. I love the stories of the women being put into the convents. Royal women were often packed off to convents when they displeased their husbands or their fathers. And in the convents, they had champagne. It was a wonderful life, but they were always afraid that some sooner or later God would catch up with them. Mm.
And when you look at the significance the Kremlin has had in the past, how do you see its future?
I think the thing about its future is because its past has been so varied, because its past has been so fragmented, we have to say its future is unpredictable. The idea that Russia is condemned always to be an authoritarian dictatorship with this very, very sort of terrifying facade, that's just their way of projecting themselves. In reality, anything could happen. And that's what's so exciting.
It's been fascinating to talk to you. I'm looking forward to leafing through this book, and it's out tomorrow.
That's right.
On October the 3rd. Catherine, thank you very much indeed. Catherine Merridale, author of Red Fortress, The Secret Heart of Russia's History. Thank you very much indeed.
In a moment, we'll be leafing through the US newspapers with Monocle's producer Danny Ciacopelli. But first, to take us there, here is Le Youth with Cool. That was Le Youth with Cool.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Victoria Graham, and Marcus Hippie. Time now, though, to take a look at the US newspapers this morning, and we're joined by Monocle producer Danny Ciacopelli. I was going to say, what do you have for us today? But I suppose it's fairly obvious with the US shutdown at the moment, that's going to be making a lot of the headlines.
That will be making a lot of the headlines. So it's day two of this shutdown where my government is kind of not functioning anymore. And
How do you feel about that?
It's kind of a circus, I think. I mean, it's a spectacle looking at it from abroad. A bit embarrassing. But you know, it's, I would say it's politics as usual, but it's not, because it's a lot of the journalism that's been going on about this, it's been focusing on this kind of two-party thing, gridlock, Washington gridlock. But it's actually not gridlock. I was reading James Fallows in The Atlantic, and he was saying it's really not Democrats, you know, v. Republicans. It's really, it's an internal Republican thing. It's the conservative element of the Republican Party fighting against the moderates to try to kind of squash the Democrats, Obama's kind of singular legislative achievement. So it's really not two heads clashing. It's one side pulling everything down. And it's hard to watch.
It's a mess, isn't it, really?
But yeah, I mean, this morning we're looking at a few of these stories coming out of the aftermath of this. There's lots of ripple effects that have been occurring, obviously, throughout the country, and some good journalism that's been going on. So I'm looking now at the Jackson Hole News and Guide in Wyoming. And Jackson Hole is a small kind of resort town in Wyoming. I've been there. It's, you know, it's where lots of people go out and they hike, they fish. They're looking at the effect of the national parks. So Yellowstone and the Grand Teton National Parks are both closed. Some are taking it well, some aren't taking it well. The writer here says the U.S. Department of Interior estimated that the shutdown 17 years ago cost the communities $14 million a day. Just in lost hotel fees, restaurant meals, souvenirs. Mm. So people are pissed. Yeah.
And it's not just within the U.S. It's actually reflected also abroad.
Yeah. So, well, before you even get abroad, Puerto Rico, which is part of the U.S., I mean, their economy is extremely at risk. Temporary loss of even 5,000 jobs, one report says, is enough to put them in the hole. So shaky ground. I mean, it's real... real effects on real people, as Obama kept saying, but it's true. I mean, it's not like some theoretical change in the structure of the government. It's affecting people right now. The Obama, as you said, overseas, he canceled a trip to Malaysia. The Malaysians are saying that. Also, the World War II Memorial in Washington. The Washington Post has a great story where a bunch of veterans tried to come. They were scheduled to come see it. 125 veterans and. They, you know, 87-year-old guys, and they weren't allowed to see it. But then they actually, someone shuffled them in, and they did allow them to see it.
It's going to have a long-lasting impact, though, this, isn't it? I mean, on tourism, on travel, we understand now that things like passport renewals and driving license renewals, they're going to be delayed. So, I mean, things really are in a bit of a state over there.
Yeah, yeah, it is, and lots of people aren't working right now either.
Dipping into the savings and such.
Moving on, should we talk about something else as well?
Yeah, so the Chinese blind dissident, you guys probably remember, I think it was last year. So this is a Chinese dissident, and he had tried to get asylum at the U.S. embassy when Hillary Clinton was visiting China. And it was a big international situation between the U.S. and China. China didn't really want him to get asylum in the U.S., but then they finally came to this agreement where he would go to New York University, NYU, which he did, and he was there for about a year. And then there was this big storm where he said NYU is caving to Chinese pressure to kick him out, which nobody really knows is true. NYU says, no, this was a one-year deal only. He said otherwise. And now he's just accepted an offer to work at a conservative think tank based in Princeton, New Jersey, the Witherspoon Institute, which lots of people are saying... is interesting to say the least. I mean, the reason he was a dissident is he was exposed forced abortions in China. So this think tank that's taking him in, it's kind of a socially conservative think tank that works on these kind of issues. So people are saying, well, this may harm his kind of how people view him because, you know, up until now he wasn't being seen as kind of a far right guy. He was just being seen as a dissident, but now he's kind of taking a stance. So it remains to be seen there. And also, I'd like to look at this issue of there's this ex-Black Panther. And the Black Panthers in the U.S., most people know, they were a militant, socialist, revolutionary African-American movement decades ago. And this guy was incarcerated in this notorious jail in Louisiana called Angola. And he was part of the Angola Three. These guys were all convicted, and they were accused. This one man was accused of killing someone in jail. Although the evidence was really never there, no fingerprints were taken, and now he's been let out after 41 years.
How can he be jailed for 41 years with
solitary.
No real evidence?
Well, yeah. I mean, back then, you know, if you were a black man in Louisiana in 1972, you know. Who knows? I mean, now he's sick, so he's been let out. But they're saying the evidence was really never there to begin with.
And he's been the subject of various documentaries, hasn't he, and films.
Exactly.
And people have been fascinated by this story.
Yep. Marcus?
I was just asking what the public opinion and discussion has been about this recently.
Yeah, well, people are saying how, exactly what we've been saying here. How could he be in jail for 40... You know, in the U.S., I mean, not to slag off the justice system, but, you know, sometimes people, you know, even get executed on flimsy evidence and... you know, it's not always good down there. Barrett Austin, our Southern correspondent, might take issue with that. yeah, and finally, let's look to L.A.
Yes.
So the Los Angeles school system quickly gave out iPads, and now they're taking them back. There we go.
Well, thank you very much in that. That's all we've got time for today. Thanks to our producer, Barbara Feeney, and our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Harriet Thorpe, and our studio manager, Bill Luty. Marcos continues after the news of the latest edition of The Menu.
Briefing is in 3 hours here on Monocle 24, and don't forget the latest edition of Monocle 24 scheduled as aperitivo at 2100 hours Moscow time, 1800 hours in London, and 10 a.m. in San Francisco. Clemency Burton Hill and Georgina Godwin will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, but now from us, thank you and goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.